From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at how former President Donald Trump's felony conviction could impact the RNC in Milwaukee. We'll meet a creative couple behind many beloved children's books.
I will often write differently if I think that I'm writing for Laura, and it makes me happy to do so. And then I love the fact that she is taking my words and interpreting them.
We'll learn about the origins of bubble tea.
There's no answer for who is the original. And maybe people in Taiwan, they don't care much. They just like boba. Whoever's from, as long as it tastes good.
Plus, we'll hear new local music in the Milwaukee Music Roundup. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll learn all about bubble tea and why the drink has become so popular. But first, former President Donald Trump is expected to come to Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention just days after his sentencing hearing. He was convicted last week of falsifying business records. Here's the latest Capitol Notes, which explores how this could impact the convention.
This is Capitol Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver. A New York City jury convicted Republican presumptive presidential nominee Donald Trump with 34 felony charges last week. J.R. Ross explains how that could affect the presidential race in our swing state of Wisconsin. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so we're talking about former President Donald Trump's convictions. Prosecutors in New York had charged him with a cover-up over hush money payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels ahead of the 2016 presidential election. What are you watching for as Milwaukee prepares to host the Republican National Convention just 4 days after his sentencing is scheduled in New York?
Well, first, I would caution everybody to take a breath. I know there's lots of like national speculation, like of how it's going to affect the campaign, like right now that's going to carry through November. I don't know we're ready to make that kind of prediction, right? Still very fresh, lots of questions out there. But the things I'm going to watch for are things like, okay, in the Marquette University Law School poll, there were 22% of Republicans who turned out in April in Wisconsin's presidential primary who did not vote for Donald Trump. They've been sticking with Trump in the Marquette poll for the most part. Does this maybe persuade some to go elsewhere, to vote third party or stay home? For the most part, he's been above 90% in the Marquette poll among self-identified Republicans. Does this change that? There's independents. A lot of them are not plugged in the news every single day, every single minute like some of us are. Does this break through the clutter that he's been convicted now of 34 felonies? That's something I'm going to watch. Marquette also does a national poll. They asked people back during the trial, if he's convicted, how that affect your vote? And it swung things toward Joe Biden. But that was a theoretical. Now it's actually happened. So what's going to happen? What we know right now, the immediacy is there's a lot of energy for Republicans at this point. The base is not happy with what's going on. And Donald Trump is raising lots of money. But can that be sustained for the next several months? We're still a lifetime away from November 5th. A lot's going to happen between now and then. Don't forget, if you go back and look at things like, you know, Donald Trump and the Access Hollywood video back in 2016, there's an immediate impact. But then after a few, 3-4 weeks, it kind of disappeared. So does this stick to Donald Trump? That's a huge question. Does it actually make an impact? And we won't know probably for a few weeks, maybe even a month, if things really, this really changed the trajectory of the race.
But of course, this is going to be something that continues to follow all the political conversations. Like, the sentencing is happening 4 days before a major, you know, political convention in this state. And, you know, there's never been a presidential candidate that's had a criminal conviction before. So, I mean, in terms of the framing of how the political conversations are going to be this year and what's important to people, is there something that you're cluing in on?
Oh, I mean, again, just watching, does this break through with people? Joe Biden and Donald Trump are not well-liked by the public. Every poll we've seen shows that. Does it, when you have an unappealing choice at the top of the ticket, does something like this change your thought process, right? There are people who are unhappy with Joe Biden because of his policies, his age, whatever reason. The ones that have been kind of supporting Trump, does this give them pause? Maybe, you know, it's just, you just got to kind of take a deep breath and relax a little bit. Let it play out for a little while, because we tend to overanalyze things in politics and want an answer right now. I'm just not sure if my conversations, the answer is going to be there and be written into stone just yet. It may take a little while.
And of course, there's some Republicans in the state that have had their disagreements with Trump. I mean, Robin Voss is one of them. He had disagreements with Trump over his request to overthrow the results of the 2020 election, and Voss was refusing to do that. Voss came out with a statement supporting Trump in this situation. Are you seeing that sort of cohesion in the Republican establishment in Wisconsin?
Among elected officials, yeah, it's been pretty unanimous, you know, defending Trump. Now, Voss is interesting because he said at one point he would do everything in his power to try and make sure Donald Trump was not the GOP nominee in 2024. Now he's calling for people to unify behind Donald Trump. And don't forget, Robin Voss is facing a recall effort by people who are unhappy with him over a number of things, including his comment that he was going to try and make sure that Trump wasn't the nominee in 2024, that he wasn't essentially loyal enough to the former president. Well, now he's calling for people to get behind him. And so that it shows you how powerful this has been for some Republicans, that they are seeing this as a miscarriage of justice and a reason to put aside concerns about Trump to kind of get behind him.
And what do you see about sort of the dichotomy or the, I guess I would say the dichotomy that Trump has built himself in the past as the law and order candidate. Now he is a felon. What are you seeing in terms of effects of people's faith in the justice system, or how those conversations are playing out in terms of people that are supporting of law and order now feeling that the justice system is a sham?
Oh, you've seen strains of that for a while with the various indictments against Trump, that he's dismiss them all as witch hunts, that they are all partisan, that this is all a two-tiered justice system. So that's not necessarily new. I don't know that you're changing anybody's mind. If you were with Trump before this, I don't know that you're going to change, because some Trump supporters actually kind of like this idea that he is taking on the system, you know, and fighting against it. But I'm kind of more watching as those Republicans who don't really care for Trump but feel like he's the better option over Joe Biden. Does this change that calculation for them? Again, we won't know for a while possibly, but do they go, you know, this is just one step too far. I know I was going to vote for Trump because I'm really happy about, let's say, inflation and Joe Biden's policies, but I just can't go there with Trump right now. Do I go to Biden? Do I go to a third party candidate, or I just stay home come November?
And do you see that the Marquette poll that was done during the hush money trial, the one that you referenced, was indicating that Trump had, among registered voters nationwide, Trump had a slight lead, and then it became a Biden lead if Trump was found guilty. Are those kind of like the people that you're talking about in that little lead margin?
Possibly, but you know, that was a theoretical question. Now it's real. So does it get more people's attention because it's actually happened? That's a huge question, I think. And again, it's going to take a while for it to sort itself out.
All right. You're tuned into Capitol Notes. I'm WWM's Maayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. So moving on to other big political stories, we've got nearly half of the legislature won't run in old districts under the new maps. Can you lay out what this means for the 2024 election?
The bigger thing is the number of departures are up to about 23 people in the assembly who are either retiring or running for a different district or different office, like the state senate or for judge. Three members of state senate who have either left, are leaving, running for something else. So it's actually not that big of a turnover. We've had three straight cycles of big turnover, like 30 people leaving last time, 2 years ago. So for all things considered, with the new map and everything, it's not that crazy. Yes, there are members who are in different numbered districts, but even though the numbers change, they're still, you know, from the same place, occupying a lot of the same territory. There are some members who have to go out and introduce themselves to new voters, and that's really the challenge. Like, let's look at Joan Baldwin, for example. She's a Republican from Marquezan in kind of south central Wisconsin. Her district had been pretty Republican for a long time. It's been redrawn to be a Democratic-leaning one, but on top of that, it moves significantly to the west and picks up brand new territory that she's never represented before. So not only is she in a district now that leans against her politically, at the top of the ticket, but it's also new people. That's an additional challenge for somebody like Joan, who's trying to fight the nature of the district to win a re-election to that seat.
And what should voters know about legislative races in southeastern Wisconsin?
Republicans were happy because Jesse Rodriguez, Republican from South Milwaukee, is going to run again. She was also drawn into a Democratic-leaning seat. She is probably Republicans' best shot to win that seat. She's been known as somebody who's on the Joint Finance Committee, the most powerful committee in the Capitol, the Budget Committee. She's won races before by running ahead of the top of the ticket. So Republicans there got a little bit of a coup because she's going to run again. That should help them. That's key because if you look at the maps and kind of start rating these districts, they're about in the mid-40s of seats that Republicans should win. About the low 40s for seats that Democrats should win. The key is about 9 to 11 seats, and some of those seats have a lean to them. Republicans can't just come back with 50 seats if they want to have a functioning majority. They know because they're members who have had their problems with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss in the past that have voted against various things. They need to be at 54, maybe 55 seats to have a functioning majority. Otherwise, it's going to look like the House of Representatives in D.C. where things don't work very well. Now, that's if Republicans maintain control. We don't know the top of the ticket just yet. Right now, it looks like a tie race with slight lean for Donald Trump. Again, it's early. We'll see. Democrats have a shot to win the majority, but they need a good performance at the top of the ticket from either a Tammy Baldwin or a Joe Biden to help set the stage for that. We're not just yet seeing like a big Dem year. So it was a 50-50 election. Probably Republicans are favored to stay in control of the Assembly. And the Senate, there aren't enough seats up this fall that are competitive that would flip control. But for Democrats, they have a shot to change that 22 to 10 majority right now with one vacancy. Get it down to like 19, 18 seats. That would set the stage for in 2026. They could then go for the majority and probably and possibly flip that chamber.
Well, thanks for being our political resource, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Hey, anytime.
J.R. Ross is with WISP Politics. You can hear his conversations with WUWM's Mayan Silver every Monday on Lake Effect. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this year's election. New episodes drop every Wednesday, leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about bubble tea. But first, we'll head to Boswell Books to talk with a husband and wife team who write and illustrate children's books. That's coming up next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Kevin Henkes is a well-known children's book author and illustrator. You may know him best for his books filled with mouse characters like Owen, Chrysanthemum, and Wemberley Worried. Once in a while, he'll team up with his wife, fine art painter Laura Drodzik, to collaborate on children's books together. Both work out of their home studios in the Madison area. Henkes writes the manuscript and then hands it off to Drodzik for her to create the visuals to pair with the story. Their new book, called Finding Things, is their eighth collaboration. It explores connections, luck, nature, and responsibility. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski met with Henkes and Drodzik at Boswell Book Company ahead of an event there.
Kevin Henkes and Laura Drodzik, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're very happy to be here.
So outside of the collaborations that you work on, you both have relatively probably solitude in your work with whatever you're working on respectively. Like you share a workspace in the same hallway, but when you do get to work together closely on a book like Finding Things, what are your favorite parts about each other's professional selves?
That's a very good question. No, I think when we do collaborate, I often, if I'm writing a book and I think that it will be for Laura, it's a different mindset for me, which is really nice. Sometimes when I'm writing a picture book and I know it's for me, I will do a lot of self-editing because I might not want to draw or paint a particular thing.
Sure.
But if I'm doing it for Laura, it sort of gives me freedom. And the way that we work really is that I love to get the manuscript to the point where I think it's perfect. I might tell Laura what I'm thinking of or read a little bit, but I really want it to be perfect when she reads it because I want her to say, yes, I would like to do this. And then once she does and our editor, Virginia Duncan, says yes, I really do give it up and let Laura do her thing. And the nice thing is in our collaborations, because she's the illustrator and it's her thing, it becomes her thing, she often adds subtext, which is wonderful. So it really is nice. I really do kind of give it up. I get to peek in because our studios are right across the hallway from one another, but I do give it up and it becomes Laura's after I do my part.
So you have the text finished before you hand it over, right? Okay, and then Laura, where do you take it from there? Do you have total freedom to interpret the text as you want?
Yeah, so Kevin will give me the manuscript, and then he doesn't give me any notes or anything really after that, just the words. And then I take usually a couple months to really think about what I'm going to do with it and let it sink in, and then I start doing sketches. And I will at that point start going back and forth with Kevin and say, you know, this is how I'm thinking about doing it, and what do you think of this? And it's nice because we can go back and forth, but he's never said you have to include this or do that. There was one time when he had an idea for birds. There was a picture where there was a wire. Mm-hmm. The birds were on the wire and then they were gone. And he said, in my mind, I just see the empty wire. And that worked great. And so but that's really been the only time.
That was the only time that happened. And that's really nice for me because it is great to see someone else interpret my words. And I think really good picture books, when the words and pictures work together the way I think they should, you can't really separate them after they're together. And I think Laura's done such a great job, and I feel so happy when I do write a book and she says yes, and then I get to see what she's done with it. And for example, in Finding Things, there's a dog that isn't mentioned in the words at all. And I had really no idea that that was going to happen. And now I can't think of this book without the dog. I think that's the magic of a really good picture book.
Right, so you both can continue to surprise each other.
Yes.
In good ways. So what do you both believe are the good, like, primary base ingredients when you're creating a new story?
I think for me, it kind of comes down to emotional truth. I want a good story. I want it to be entertaining for the child. I really want it to be for a child. I think good books often are thickly textured and maybe layered and have an understory that, you know, adults can appreciate and enjoy, but I really want it to be for a kid. That's really important to me. But I think emotional truth, and when I'm writing a book, I really want good sentences. And that means different things with different kinds of books. If it's a really young picture book, I want to pare it down so that there are only the words that are necessary, but yet leaving enough space between the words and between the sentences to have a subtext. One of my favorite authors and illustrators is M.B. Gofstein, and she says a quote, it's something like, you work and work and work until it looks like you didn't work at all. And when I'm writing a text, I read it aloud over and over and over again, because there is the hope that this book will be loved and read again and again. And I want it to sound right, and I want it to feel right, have the right rhythm. So that's really, really important to me.
Exactly. Yeah. There's when we're adults, it's not deceptive necessarily, but like you don't realize how much work it takes to be simple, right? Mm-hmm. Like both yes. in the words and the illustration. So for you, Laura, when you have, you know, the words that Kevin has fine-tuned, you know, down to that final draft, how do you approach that same kind of thing in illustrating for it?
I often think about the fact that this is the first exposure for a lot of kids to art, and so I want to make sure that the pictures really add another layer and have good design and are interesting, but also really interesting to a child. And it's an interesting interplay between doing fine art painting and then switching to illustration, because sometimes I think, oh, well, I should do more, but I really try to pare it down and make it simpler but appealing mm-hmm. to a child. And when I first am looking at the words and reading them over and over, I try to figure out how can I add more to this? How can I add more to the pictures that will keep a child interested, and also the reader, the parent, as they keep going over and over it, so that there's new things to look at. And that part's really fun, like to just, you know, keep changing things and moving things around and trying to figure out how the flow works as you do the page turn. So I think about all those things, and it takes a long time. I mean, it looks easy.
Yeah. Well, about how long did it take for finding things to come together?
That took me a really long time, because I was initially thinking that I would have a child, and the more that I worked on it, the more I thought, I don't want it to be specifically, it just seemed too direct, like having this kid finding things, you know. So trying to figure out how to make it interesting in a way that was still true to the text was challenging. So I would say it took me longer to figure out how to do this book than any of the other books that I've done, even though to me it looks simpler than any of the other books that I've done.
Yeah.
And I just discovered this. I hadn't remembered it, but now that the book is out, I went over my files for it to do book talks, and I realized that the very first draft of this book I wrote in July of 2015, and I didn't give it to Laura until December of 2022, and I have many, many drafts in between. And that often yeah. happens, where I'll just keep something, I'll put it away for a while, I'll bring it out, I'll reread it. And looking at my draft, sometimes not much has changed, but it's just a word. Sometimes it's a word that might have fewer or more syllables to just get the rhythm right. So again, it is something that often looks very simple, but often to get to that point takes a while.
For sure. So I'd love to talk a little bit more about your process. So you both live in the Madison area and you have home studios. And from what I understand, you stay away from like tech, email, all that kind of stuff, right?
Oh, I do.
You do, Laura
does not. I mean,
someone has to have email.
Yes.
But I write in longhand on notebook paper. And even if I'm writing a novel, I write it in longhand and I rewrite the whole thing in longhand one time again. If I'm working on a picture book, it's the same thing, longhand on paper. And then I type on an old typewriter that was actually Laura's when she was in college. And when I'm drawing, the way I do it, I'll do my finished sketches, and when I need to transfer it to my good paper, unlike a lot of people who have really beautiful big light up drawing desks, I have a Mickey Mouse Club 10 by 12 plastic drawing desk that I've had since I was a kid that I still use. And when my illustrations are too large, I have to do them in pieces, or I tape it to the window.
Yeah.
I'm very, very, very low tech.
Well, I'm wondering, does that help you keep like in that child wonder mindset? Like, how does that help you still continue to make so many children's books over the years? Do you think that's part of the charm that comes through on the page?
I don't know if that's the case, or it's just the case of I don't like change. And so, and even many of my illustrations are pen and ink and watercolor, and my pen holders are from a Christmas card contest that I won when I was in seventh grade. I still use them. And my water that I use when I'm cleaning my brushes for my watercolors, it's a red Imperial margarine container that I've had since I was in the fourth grade. So I think the issue is I don't like change.
Well, how do you think you balance out those sensibilities, Laura?
Well, I have emails.
You take care of the logistics, yeah.
Kevin takes advantage of that. But I don't use any technology in illustrating. Mm-hmm. And I know that people can do amazing things using the computer. But I really like the tactile, you know, sense of putting pen to paper. And when I'm doing, I can show you.
Yes, please.
So when I'm initially doing storyboards, I'll do these little tiny sketches. And you can see for this, there were little people. I mean, it's very minimal. And that's how I think about doing things. And I have an iPad, and I use that for reference, which actually is wonderful. So if I need to look at, you know, a bush or something like that, that's different than it used to be. I'd go to the library and get books, and now I use it for that.
Okay.
But I just think while I'm painting.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's how I work things out.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't ever gotten used to using the computer for doing any kind of artwork. And
yeah.
I don't think I probably ever will.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how did the two of you feel creating for each other?
I love it. And it's a nice connection. It's a different way. Sort of like I said before, I will often write differently if I think that I'm writing for Laura, and it makes me happy to do so. And then I love the fact that she is taking my words and interpreting them. You know, seeing my words through her eyes is, you know, it's a nice present for me to receive.
How about for you, Laura, with painting for Kevin?
Well, it's really wonderful to be able to take a text that always is so good, and I see the process of how it evolves over time, because he'll usually show me. I mean, a couple times he's surprised me with texts, but he is such a good writer that it really is such a pleasure. And yeah, it's just such a nice collaboration. And we know other people are like, how can you work together, you know, in the same place all these years? And yeah. Not that there's ever, you know, there's never anything that drives you nuts, but we really get along, and it's just been a very easy collaboration over the last however many years.
For sure. Well, I want to thank you both for the gifts that you keep on giving audiences, and I'm sure will for years to come, and thank you for spending some time with me today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Kevin Henkes is the author, and Laura Drodzik is the illustrator of their latest children's picture book called Finding Things. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski at Boswell Books. You can listen to more of their conversation at WUWM.com. Bubble tea shops have been popping up all over the Milwaukee area. It's a drink that can come in all flavors and levels of sweetness, with tea or no tea, milk or no milk, and often with signature tapioca pearls and jellies at the bottom. WUWM's Mayan Silver looks at the Taiwanese origins of the drink.
In a small kiosk in Mayfair Mall's second-story food court, Xiao Xiang Hu is brewing fresh jasmine tea. Pitchers of black, Thai, and oolong teas are lined up in a rainbow of colors.
Our teas are all overseas. So our Assam tea, black tea, are from India. Our jasmine tea are from China. And oolong from Taiwan.
What makes a bubble tea shop different than a regular tea shop is the reliance on boba, tapioca pearls made of cassava flour. Generally served cold, it can also have other sweet jellies or popping balls that go in the bottom of your drink and are sucked up by a big, thick straw. At Bubblicious in Mayfair, Hu stirs a pot of bubbling boba as steam coils out of the top. She rinses the boba and starts to make a popular Taiwanese bubble tea drink.
A tiger black milk tea.
When you put together a bubble tea, most toppings go in first.
Here we go, the boba in the cup.
Hu squeezes brown sugar syrup down the sides of the cup.
So they kind of like a tiger stripe on there. And then
she pours in some crisp black tea. scoop some ice from the freezer, gently drops the ice into the tea, tops the tea off with some creamy Wisconsin milk.
And here is the Tiger Black Milk Tea.
Who seals the drink with a pour-proof layer of plastic. As she shakes up the drink, the sweet white cream leisurely marbleizes through the black tea. The drink is now ready for a customer to puncture the top and sip away.
Here we go.
The tapioca starch for boba comes from the South American cassava plant. According to Eater magazine, cassava arrived in Taiwan via Southeast Asia in the 19th century, and people there already had a taste for jelly-like starch desserts. Bubble tea originated in Taiwan in the 1980s. It's a story of competing tea shops, and who really came up with putting tapioca pearls in tea is disputed territory. Here's Li Chi Chai, president of UWM's Taiwanese Student Association, who met us at Elite Boba on Farwell. He's from one of the cities that claims to have started boba tea culture in Taiwan.
So I'm originally from Taichung, Taiwan, which is the center of Taiwan. I should say like the boba tea restaurant is called Chun Shui Tang, and then that's originally from Taichung. There's a debate between Chun Shui Tang in Taichung and then also another Hanlin tea shop in Tainan. They're debating like who is the original.
The shops went to court in a prolonged lawsuit over bubble tea, but no one ended up with any trademarks or patents.
There's no answer for who is the original, and maybe people in Taiwan, they don't care much. They just like boba. Whoever's from, as long as it tastes good.
And if you're wondering about the names bubble tea and boba, well, bubble comes not from the additions to the tea itself, but because the tea is originally hand-shaken, which leaves little bubbles at the top of the tea. Boba now refers to the tapioca pearls in particular. But the story goes, a famous and busty Taiwanese film star ordered pearl milk tea. The pearls got nicknamed boba, which was also slang for large breasts. These days, you can get fruity teas with jellies that are rectangular, not round, and taste sweeter like a firm jello. At places like Elite Boba, you can also get pudding or cheese top, which is a layer of more firm, savory, yogurt-like cream that you can mix into your tea.
If you like savory flavor, you definitely want to try cheese on top.
Back at Bubblicious in Mayfair Mall, Xiao Xuan Hu saw Nina Chesser tentatively approach the kiosk.
What's that?
All right.
The bubbles?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. You do want it.
Yeah.
Have you had it before?
No. Never had it.
Chesser's daughter had been urging her to try it. So she ordered, and Hu walked her through her first sip of a boba milkshake.
You'll poke through.
And the verdict?
Delicious.
Ma'ayan Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Coming up next, we'll explore some new songs by local musicians in the Milwaukee Music Roundup. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It seems like every day another festival is releasing its summer lineup of events. Festival season is a cherished tradition here in Milwaukee. And what is a festival without live local music? With so much to look forward to, we're checking out some new songs from local musicians to get ready for the season with Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. With so much to look forward to, we're checking out some new songs from local musicians to get ready for the season with Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild. Every month, Wild creates a list of some of the best new releases from local musicians called the Milwaukee Music Roundup. He joins me now to share a few of those songs. Matt Wild, thank you as always for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you as always for having me on.
So we have four very different songs for this month. We're going to start with a genre that has been very popular in Milwaukee over the last few years. It's what I would describe as kind of alt-country, a little folksy. This is going to be a group, I'm not sure if we've talked about them before, Lady Bird.
I don't think so. Yeah, this is Lady Bird. And among the, you're right, I think it is a very, this is a very popular genre, very, just a general country genre that's going on in Milwaukee right now. And among the many bands and groups that are doing this sound, I think Lady Bird is one of the best. Now, Lady Bird has been around for maybe 4 or 5 years or something like that. And they've released a couple of EPs of music and they've been great. But now, just as we're speaking, they are releasing, I guess, their first full-length album. It is called Amy, Come On Home. And even though it is kind of their first full-length album, it definitely feels to me like a very kind of mature-sounding sophomore album that a band might release. Their previous songs were a lot of fun, and there are a lot of fun songs on this new record, but especially the song we're going to be listening to right now, which is the lead-off single on this record, like I said, has a very mature, very somber, kind of a sepia-toned kind of vibe to it. The song we're going to be listening to is called Audrey's Garden, and it's a song that's about kind of just, you know, the passage of time and the toll that it takes on all of us. And kind of the narrator of the song, the singer, the group, Pete McDermott, kind of like hearing these stories of the town that he grew up with, all these people that he grew up with, and kind of hearing what they're up to now, and you know, kind of time, like I said, taking its toll and people passing away and people moving on. And it's a very somber song, very, very lovely. And like I said, this whole record has that vibe. There are a lot of fun songs on it. There's another great song on this record called Short King Shuffle, which is another terrific one. But the one we'll be listening to right now is very lovely. It's called Audrey's Garden. It is the latest from Lady Bird.
Audrey's Garden by Lady Bird. The next song that we're going to listen to, I'm not familiar with the artist. I will say the title and the subject is very close to home. This is a song seemingly all about journalism.
Yes, I thought you would appreciate this one, Joy. Certainly the name of the song and the name of the record, in fact, are The Journalist. And the group is Ravi Lola. Now, Ravi Lola, another group that has been around maybe even longer than Lady Bird. And their last record, it's been a little while. Back in 2019, Ravi Lola, the lead singer, his name is Casey Seymour. And he's kind of had a rotating group of musicians backing him over the years. Back in 2019, they put out a really neat record called Neighborhood Daydream. And this was kind of a concept record about, I believe, kind of like his River West neighborhood. There was a song about the local mailman. There was a song about the little free libraries in the neighborhood. And there was even a song about beloved Milwaukee historian John Gerda. Now, 6 years later, Ravi Lola is back and they have this new record. It's called The Journalist. And it, too, is kind of a concept album. Ravi Lola, I really like their sound. They are kind of this very Baroque twee, and I use twee in a good way, not in a bad way. A very twee kind of psychedelic band. They remind me a lot of like very, very early of Montreal. Their latest record is called The Journalist, and like I said, it is kind of a concept album about a person, not so much a profession, but about a person. The record just came out, so I haven't dug too deep into it. I haven't sussed out all the concepts of it yet, but I really like what I've heard so far. So the song we're going to be listening to is the title track from the new Ravi Lola record. It is called The Journalist.
The Journalist by Ravi Lola. We're going to switch gears here a bit. This next song comes from a real institution, it seems like he has become here in Milwaukee. This is going to be from Classic.
Absolutely. I think institution is a great way to describe Classic. I was looking back, speaking of that, and boy, yeah, he has been releasing music in Milwaukee since about 2012. So it's been like 12 years of Classic, and always dependable, always really fascinating to see what he's up to. He comes from this really interesting background of both kind of a very jazz influenced background, hip hop as well, and just kind of all over the board. And his stuff has always been fascinating to me over the years. He has a new EP out right now. It's called Workers' Comp. And the song we're going to be listening to from it is called Run It Up. And I was listening to the song and watching the video for it, and I was really trying to figure out how to describe it. It's got this very ethereal feel to it. It's very atmospheric. And the video has him kind of like in the woods, kind of singing along to the song. And I was like, boy, how to describe this? And then I was looking at his website, and he kind of described it so perfectly that I just have to read like how he describes what he's up to these days. Classic says, "My artistic identity and mission is clearer than it ever has been. I'm an artist through and through, and I don't fit into any box, nor do I desire to. When you're talking about what the music is, it is electro, rap, and soul. What you're looking for, a way to describe who I am as an artist and what my artist practice is, you can call me a black pastoral sonic landscape painter." I really, really like that description, a black pastoral sonic landscape painter. I think that perfectly describes the feel of this song. It's always great to hear new music from Classic, and this is one of the newest from him. It's from his Workers' Comp EP, and the song is called Run It Up.
Funny how
Running Up by Classic. The final song we're going to talk about, speaking of 2012, or at least speaking of old songs, this is a song that is actually 11 years old. It's from a group that I last saw at, I believe, Dirt Nap Fest over in Madison. This is a song from The Sugar Stems.
Absolutely, yeah, The Sugar Stems. And, for these segments, I always like to choose new music. Sometimes, it'll be something that was released the previous month, or maybe sometimes I'll dig back a little further than that. This one, I'm definitely going back. Like you said, the song is about 11, 12 years old from The Sugar Stems. And the reason I'm including it is because, well, two reasons, actually. One, The Sugar Stems, who were this fantastic power pop group that were active in the early 2010s in Milwaukee. They're still together, but they very rarely play shows. And they are playing a very rare show at Locust Street Festival in June. So I'm really, really looking forward to seeing them. Haven't seen them play in years. I know, like you said, they did play last year at Dirt Nap Fest, which is the label that the records were on. But I haven't seen them in a long time, so I'm really excited to see them at Locust Street Festival. The second reason I'm choosing this song, which is called Love You to Pieces. If I had to choose, not that this would ever come up, but if someone said to me, Matt, what is your favorite Milwaukee song of all time? I would maybe probably have to choose this song. The Sugar Stems, Love You to Pieces. I think it's a perfect song. It is a perfect power pop song. The music is fantastic. The lyrics and the whole kind of conceit of the song is so perfect and so funny. I love the Sugar Stems. This is from their 2012-2013 record. It's called Can't Wait. They had records on either side of that record that were also fantastic, but this is probably my favorite of theirs. I'm really looking forward to seeing them again. And so I thought, why not? Let's just listen to some Sugar Stems. So this from back in the 2010s, this is one of the Milwaukee greats with one of their greatest songs. It is the Sugar Stems with Love You to Pieces.
Never liked the taste of bubble gum until I took a piece and put it on my tongue.
Love You to Pieces from Sugar Stems. Now we are getting really into the height of summer season, of festival season. What are you looking forward to?
Well, you're right. We're basically in it at this point. It's fascinating because the kind of lakefront festival season is starting a little early this year with Festa Italiana. And then after that, like I said, is Locust Street Festival. Then Summer Solstice is the following weekend. And then after that is Summerfest. And so here we are in the thick of it. I'm really looking forward to kind of taking it all in. And like I said, kind of taking in all the local music. And even something as big as Summerfest has a lot of local music this year. In fact, the first group we listened to, Lady Bird, they are playing Summerfest this year. They're playing July 5th. Early afternoon, 1 p.m. on the big old Miller Lite Oasis stage. And they're not alone. There's a whole bunch of Milwaukee artists that are kind of scattered throughout the schedule for Summerfest. And certainly all the, block parties and kind of smaller festivals are loaded with local music. So it's just a fantastic time of year just to be out. And it's such a fantastic time to be a fan of local Milwaukee music because just everyone is out there playing all the time from now until, September, till the Bayview Bash kind of wraps things up. So I'm really looking forward to the next few months. And here we go.
Here we go indeed. Well, Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup, and he shares a few of those songs with us. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll celebrate Pride Month by learning about Milwaukee's lesbian history. Plus, we'll talk with the first openly transgender police officer in Wisconsin. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.